All right, welcome to Lecture 1. This is the audio and video commentary for the PowerPoint that's titled on the first slide, Intro to Forest Recreation, Definitions and Relationships. The idea here is just to establish what we mean by some keywords when we say them, because they're going to sound like some common words, but they have very specific meanings when you talk about forestry and forest recreation as a profession. Okay? First, leisure. We'll have a discussion forum thread on what does that term mean to you. But for a lot of people, it can mean some very different things. So, we're going to talk about a little bit of what leisure meant throughout the ages, so to speak, here in a bit in the class, but for the moment, think for a sec. What does leisure mean to you? If you got a whole bunch of unobligated time, meaning you don't have any deadlines looming right now, there's nobody standing behind your shoulder saying, you've got to get this done, you've got to get that done. What do? How do you spend that time? Do you sleep? Do you do something sort of relaxing and low-key, maybe sit on the couch, watch TV? Do you do something that requires a lot of maybe skill and or effort, like downhill mountain biking? Do you do something that is extremely difficult and intense, like certain kinds of sports, right? We'd class all of those things as leisure, but they're not necessarily all the same thing for all people, okay? Now, in the 1700s, leisure meant something very, very different just because the basic concepts of sort of how people survived were pretty different than what they are now. So, in the 1700s, social historians, people who look at the history of lots and lots of people, not just necessarily famous people, have figured out that typically, folks during that century would spend about 12 hours a day on what we call subsistence. So, let's say 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. on average, 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., 12 hours a day, people were subsisting, that is, working, or doing whatever they needed to in terms of craft, being involved in a market, farming, whatever, for most people, probably farming. That typically took about 12 hours a day. Okay? And then you had to spend about 11 hours a day on existence. That is, spending time keeping your physical self alive. So, sleeping. Call it 8 hours on average a day. You've got to wash every once in a while in the 1700s. Today, typically, folks are taking a shower or bath every day or a couple of days. Okay? It also takes a long time, relatively speaking, versus what we're used to, in the 1700s to prepare breakfast, lunch, and dinner, right? We don't have things like microwaves or canned goods or somebody maybe butchering the chicken and or the hog for us. So we spend a whole lot of time basically having foodstuffs available and on the table and safely cooked, okay? It's also, at that point, across most of the world and still true in some places in the world where, for example, you had to spend a whole bunch of time gathering water, walking to the well, cranking up 8 pounds per gallon on the little winder, if they had one, or just pulling up the rope, and then hauling that heavy water back, right? So water weighs a lot, about a ton per cubic meter. So to have enough for your family to eat, drink, water any animals you had, like chickens or hogs or whatever, and then, of course, to bathe to keep yourself clean and hygienic, at least every once in a while, that took a huge amount of time and effort. So that added up to about 11 hours a day. In terms of free time, that leaves us, if you're doing the math at home, about an hour, which is not a whole lot of time for leisure. So your free time, your unstructured time, that 1 hour you get a day on average is gonna be pretty much tied up with family, especially in the 1700s when family sizes tended to rise, run a little bit larger than they do today. If you fast forward to 1950, things look a little bit different. We have now typically about 10 hours a day versus 12 spent on subsistence, that is work. So at least in the United States and across most of Western Europe, which is where we'll generally focus our conversation, 8-hour workday, right? And some European countries are actually moving to a much shorter workday, 7 or even 6.5 hours a day officially. And then call it an hour commute and prep time on either end, and that gives you about 10 hours a day. We still spend about 10 hours a day on existence, so we've been able to shave an hour off of cooking, sleeping, eating, showering, stuff like that, with all the modern conveniences of Western industrialized society. And that leaves about 4 hours a day for unstructured time, or discretionary time, or leisure. So whatever that means to you, on average, typically have about 4 hours a day for it once you have some kind of a regular job, okay? Also in Western society, we also divide leisure into days of the week a little bit differently than we used to. So with the Industrial Revolution came things like the concept of the weekend, right? Before that time, people worked 6 or 7 days a week, depending on your religious or spiritual practice, and then that leftover day, if any, was most of your leisure time. These days, with the circumscribing of the workday into an officially 8 hours period or slightly less, that means you can have a little bit more leisure time on average on a typical day. Okay. If you head over to the workweek hours slide, social historians have sort of charted the progression of how many hours on average you work per week, and it's been a pretty recognizable trend between 1840 and now, the year 2000, when these figures were last updated by the U.S. Census Bureau, right? So in 1840, a typical work week for an average everyday workaday person was about 70 hours a week. Now, these days we still have folks that work 70 hours a week, but on average people are reporting that we're spending about 40 to 41 hours a week working, okay? So that means we've got a whole lot more time for things like leisure. These days, if we fast forward from 1950 to 2010, from the 4-hour chunk of leisure to the sort of blended time of leisure, we have a pretty different system going on now. With the advent of, in particular, networked electronics, now, on the upside, you can take your work home to work on it at home. On the downside, that means you are taking your work home and working on it at home. So that means we now tend to look at time as divided between existence time, about 10 hours a day still, about the same as 1950, with microwaves and toaster ovens and canned foods and preservatives and freezers and showers and all of that. That hasn't really changed much. But now we look at a more blended model of how people spend their work and play time. Okay, so one way that this can take shape is, for example, if you are a business person and you go on a golf outing with a sales client, for example, and you're trying to cultivate the contract, get them to sign on the dotted line and buy your product, whatever it is. Okay, but you're out on the golf course to do it. A lot of business deals happen on golf courses and places like that. So the question becomes, is that work or play? Because you are trying to sell your product, for example, but you're also on a golf course. So it's a much more blended sense, a much less well-defined boundary between what is work time and what is play time. Okay? So that's interesting, and it leaves a whole lot of space for leisure sort of undefined in terms of classical definitions, right? Leisure used to be that time or that place or that trip where you were very clearly not working. These days, people take their leisure pretty seriously and also find lots of ways to blend it into work, okay? Second question for you. How much free time would you say that you have as a student? We'll start a discussion thread on the forums for that as well, okay? It's always interesting to hear people's answers on this. They range all over the place. All right, let's take a look at some of the formally defined components of leisure so that we understand what we mean when we say that word, okay? That way we're all working from a common basis. So, way back when, we used to look at leisure as free time, unobligated time, and or discretionary time. That is, nobody else has placed requirements on how I have to spend the next hour, so that next hour is going to be leisure. Okay? These days, we don't necessarily place it specifically under those definitions. We're going to place it in a slightly more benefits-based approach. That is, if something has the benefits traditionally ascribed to leisure, like relaxation, restoration, recreation, the challenge and skill opportunities involved with that, we're going to start calling that leisure, as well as it being sort of free time, unobligated time, and discretionary time. Okay, so it may be passive or active, it may be indoors, outdoors, it may be structured or unstructured, lots of different shapes that leisure can take, but as long as it has those specific characteristics of sort of unobligated time and bringing the benefits of what have been identified as the benefits of leisure, then we'll call that leisure for our purposes in this class. Okay? Next slide. Stages of leisure. This is sort of the degree to which it's intense. Okay? Or the time scale, if you like to think of it that way. So, these days with the ever-present cell phone, it is impossible to peel my students away from their cell phones. There's lots of opportunities for a quick bite of leisure here or there when you're playing, what, Candy Crush, Plants vs. Zombies, something quick on your phone, right? Maybe you're in the restroom for a few minutes and you pull out your cell phone. Maybe you are on the bus to campus. You got a few minutes there and you're just kind of relaxing. Your brain's not really chewing through what you got to do for that day. So it's free time. It might be fun time. We call that opportunistic leisure. That is a new thing in the past few decades, especially in the past 5 years with the advent of mobile computing. Okay? Or ubiquitous mobile computing, at least. Next stage up from there would be weekday leisure. And that would be things like, you know, spending an hour or two playing a video game. So the slide here is a little bit outdated. Modern Warfare 2 is not the latest thing these days. What, Titanfall? I don't know. Whatever your thing is. One step up from there, of course, is the weekend scale. So now you've got more than a few hours at the end of your day, typically. Maybe if you're a student living on campus, those hours are at the beginning of your day. Hey, I don't judge. At the weekend scale, we've got things like all-day or overnight scale recreation and leisure in general, okay? So that's things like the overnight camping trip. If you're way into gaming, it might be something like the old school World of Warcraft raid where you're going to get 40 or 50 people and it takes hours upon hours to go through it, okay? The next logical extension from having a weekend or a long weekend free for leisure is to look at the annual scale. Typically in the United States, since we're a northern and western hemisphere nation, that's going to be a summertime thing. So if you've ever been on the annual family camping trip in the middle of the summer, this is you. That was annual scale recreation. Okay? So the only place we can go from here is sort of full-time recreation, and that's generally going to happen with two or three classes of people. First, children, especially children before their school age. They've got pretty much all day to do, within the limits set by their parents, whatever they want to. That would be leisure. The next class would be typically folks who have just graduated high school or college, maybe graduate school, and you've got totally unstructured time. Maybe you haven't started a career-scale job yet, and if you wanted to go backpacking for 6 months, you could do it, right? It could happen. The third class of folks who tend to be able to do sort of full-time leisure if they want to are retirees. So we tend to see folks in one of those three life stages able to enjoy or engage with leisure at that scale. Okay? All right. So take a look through a couple of slides. I got some photos of each one of those, or animated images if you're watching the PowerPoint in full screen. Fancy. Okay? And try to think, do I have any of these memories that map onto what Dr. Park's talking about here? So, in the past week, have I done anything on the weekday or weekend leisure scale? Have I played any video games? Did I go for a run? Did I take my dog out for a walk, for a long walk, for a couple of hours? And it was a couple of hours because we could, not because we had to, right? See if you can find any examples of those in your own life. All right, we're on to the classes of leisure slide now. So, serious leisure versus casual leisure. When you start looking at leisure and talking to people who are engaged with it either professionally or engaged in leisure personally for the sake of leisure, you tend to find that there's a huge range in terms of kind of the intensity of it, right? So, it could be anything from a few minutes of idle time, picking your nose at the bus stop, waiting for the next thing to happen. You could call that leisure. And way at the other end of that, you have folks sailing around the world trying to beat world records. You have folks hiking from Alaska down to Tierra del Fuego at the very southern tip of Argentina. Thousands and thousands of miles. Might take a couple of years. And yet, we don't really call that work for most of those people. So if it's not work and it's not survival, that is existence time, it's got to be leisure. In some sense. So, think for yourself. Do I tend to gravitate towards things that look kind of work-like in terms of time and effort and intensity? do I wrap a lot of my identity around this particular leisure activity? Is my community in part or maybe wholly defined by this particular activity? So, for example, if you're a mountain biker, are you a mountain biker? And that's sort of what defines who you are, or is it just something you sort of do if you got a couple hours extra free time, right? A lot of different leisure activities, a lot of different leisure industries can be located on that spectrum between totally casual, low-intensity idle time and very high-intensity, typically very expensive, typically much more reliant on highly developed skill sets, technical equipment, access to difficult-to-reach places, and so forth, very intense or serious leisure, okay? All right, next slide. Let's classify sort of some subsets of leisure, and pretty clearly or pretty quickly you'll see where we're going with this. All right, so if you think of leisure as all the different ways we could spend our unstructured or discretionary time and money and energy and attention, we typically come up with four broad classes, right? So recreation, which this class is all about, sports, which tend to look a lot like recreation but have some key differences we'll talk about, pastimes like hobbies, and then entertainment, like watching TV, going to a Broadway musical or a touring show, something like that, okay? Now, within recreation, we're actually mostly concerned with outdoor recreation, right, as a forestry class. And within outdoor recreation, we've got things like marine rec, alpine recreation, that is high-altitude mountain recreation primarily, or very high-latitude, so north or south pole-type recreation, or forest recreation. And we'll use forest recreation as sort of a container for things like prairie, forest, woodland, which is a very open kind of low-density forest, beach, backyard, neighborhood. All of those things we'll class as forest recreation, okay? And then if we go one step further on sort of the specialization of definitions here, let's talk about wildland recreation. This is pretty much the heart and soul of what this class is about. So wildland recreation is the subset of forest recreation, which is a subset of outdoor rec, which is a subset of rec, which is a subset of leisure. Wildland recreation is the stuff that is very closely and intimately attached to natural resources. So if you've ever been hiking in a wilderness area, that's what I'm talking about. If you've ever been out on a boat and you can't see any lights on the shoreline at night, that's what I'm talking about. If you are sitting on top of a mountain and the only town or road you can see is way off on the horizon, maybe 80 or 100 miles away, that's what I'm talking about. That's wildland recreation, okay? And as it turns out, it is really pretty difficult to provide that in a high-quality form for the millions, literally millions of folks, even just in the United States, who are looking for it. So part of this class is all about not just learning to recognize wildland forest recreation, but how to provide it, how to make sure it's healthy for both the participants, you and me, hopefully, and for the resources involved, like the fish and the air and the soil. All of these things have to work together to provide good quality, sustainable, and or resilient forest wildland recreation. Okay? All right. So we're going to transition now to a couple more definitions, and then we'll get into a little bit of history. So recreation then, now we're talking about then as in a very sort of old school definition, like classical Greek and Roman ancient civilization type stuff. Okay? So recreation then was regarded as a subset of leisure, and the basic idea for the classical civilizations, that is Greek and Rome, and to a lesser extent affiliated civilizations around the Mediterranean, were based on the idea that recreation was a very intentional kind of thing, a very constructive kind of thing, but a very narrowly sort of defined way to spend your time, based on the idea of stepping away from work so that you can recreate yourself. That's where we get recreation. Recreation of the self. So refreshing, renewing. They looked at it as a very sort of metaphorical kind of rebirth. So it's a very, what we would call today, a very utilitarian view. I'm not doing recreation because it's fun. I'm doing it because it is healthy, in the same way that I take a vitamin because that's supposed to be good for me, that sort of thing. Okay. These days, we look at it in a pretty different sense. Now I'm on the recreation now in you slide. Okay? Now we look at, we manage, we plan for, we market forest and outdoor recreation as providing a whole bunch of benefits, like positive affect. Okay? Affect with an A, when it's used as a noun, means your feelings, your emotional state. What's your sort of emotional set point relative to doing fun things? Okay? Fun, challenging things. Sometimes fun, dangerous things. Sometimes fun, expensive things. It has a lot to do with providing you what's called perceived competence in two flavors. Okay? So, perceived competence in terms of instrumental competence means, okay, how good do I think I am at doing my recreation activity or my leisure activity? That is, am I really good at watching TV? Or am I really good at long-distance backpacking? Or am I really good at Tai Bo? I don't know. Does anybody remember Tai Bo? Anyway, comparative perceived competence is how you evaluate your ability to do the leisure or recreation activity relative to other people. So not so much how good am I, but how good am I relative to the other mountain bikers around me? How good am I relative to not just the other fishermen around me, but to the other fly fishermen, the ones doing the specific activity that I'm keyed into? We would call that perceived comparative competence. How do I think I stack up against them? And typically, the longer you do something, the more intensively you do something, you grow in both of those perceived competences, okay? Competencies. That is, you genuinely do get better at instrumental competency. You actually can catch the fish a little bit more often. You're able to get the hook out of the fish and throw it back without mangling the fish completely, okay? You tend to also sort of move up in sort of comparative competence as well, right? Unless other folks are moving it faster than you are. Okay, it's also about satisfying an intrinsic, there's the keyword, intrinsic motivation or desire. So we don't really call it leisure or recreation if somebody is holding a gun to your head to go fish. If that's ever happened to you, where do you live? I'd like to move where you live. Okay, but it's the idea that it's intrinsically motivated. An internal locus of control is another thing, another handle to grasp that by. That is, you're doing it because you want to. You're doing it because you want to receive the benefits or the perceived benefits of that particular activity in that particular setting. Okay? So it's not just the activity, that is, hiking, fishing, hunting. It's about the experience that you get out of it. Okay, so when we're talking about recreation, we're mostly focusing on the experience and the quality of the experience and the quality of the resources attached to that experience versus just the activity. That activity is just sort of an attribute of the experience. Okay, next, it's also about perceived freedom. Okay, that is, again, another way to look at this idea of internal locus of control versus an external locus of control or extrinsic motivation, deriving from without instead of within. Okay, so at one extreme, you would be sort of the Western concept of a slave. You have zero discretion over where you live, what you eat, how you spend your time. We would call that sort of recognizable 1860s vintage slavery. Okay, versus at the far end of perceived freedom, you could have a very, very high degree of sort of internal control about decision-making. So perceived behavioral control is the technical term there. All right. If I want to go hiking today, do I have perfect discretion to do that? I just go where I want, how I want to get there, spend the amount of time that I want, and then I can come home when and how I want to. Or do I have to borrow the keys from my wife? Do I have to fill out a permit at not even the trailhead, but the office administering the trail, so that I can go to the trailhead, fill in a logbook, and then go on my hike, right? That would be somewhere in between slavery and perfect, complete discretion or control over the situation, okay? And finally, the idea that recreation is active instead of passive is what distinguishes it from other kinds of leisure, like entertainment, for example. So, at a very basic level, entertainment scholars would disagree for intense fans of something. But at a very basic level, entertainment is primarily passive. You're sitting on the couch watching TV. You're sitting in the cinema seat watching the movie and hopefully not texting too much. But outdoor recreation and sports are very active. You're physically moving. Your brain is very active. Your emotional state is actively changing and being regulated by what you're doing. Okay? So, one key distinguishing factor in recreation and sports in this case versus other kinds of leisure is going to be that it's active versus passive. Okay? You also see some other benefits of recreation. So we tend to evaluate the success of a particular recreation trip or the success of a particular park ranger in providing these things in terms of personal change. So if you attend a campfire talk at a national park, which has been a very popular thing for many decades, we'll talk about how sort of that history evolved a little bit later. Did that ranger leading that talk encourage you at all to change, to become better in some way, to recycle more, or to respect wildlife a little bit better, or even be able to identify wildlife and realize that it's near you most of the time in various different species, okay? Also, we see big benefits in terms of self-efficacy, which is the fancier technical way of saying, do you have a sense inside of yourself, regardless of the task involved, that you can contribute positively to completing that task, right? If the task is climbing a mountain for the fun of it, that would be outdoor recreation. Do you have any sense in yourself that you can be effective in climbing the mountain or riding down the mountain at very high speed and downhill mountain biking and so forth? Okay. Other benefits involve different sort of evolutions or positive, hopefully, adaptations of aspects of your personality or intellect. Okay, so for example, let's skip forward to the slide that says self-efficacy, and it has four bubbles arrowed into it. Okay, so four things are going to help you determine for yourself a sense of self-efficacy. First, past successes. So if this isn't the first time you've ever been fishing, it's likely that any time in the past that you have successfully pulled a fish out of the water and gone, oh, this was even sort of the kind of fish I was looking for. Excellent. All right, those past successes build in you a sense of self-efficacy, and they tend to snowball. That is, you tend to get better and better as you go, as long as there are no external factors that harm that sense of self-efficacy, like, for example, the lake shutting down where you like to go fish. Second, vicarious successes. What are vicarious successes? Those are successes related to your particular activity that have a lot to do with the community, not so much you, but that you have access to through those members in the community. So, for example, if you love to fish, to continue on our example, and somebody 50 meters down from you on the shoreline pulls out a monster huge bass, or in the John boat or bass boat 150 yards away, pulls out just monster fish, you can experience the success they are experiencing vicariously through them. So maybe you didn't catch the fish, but hey, it's exciting the fish is here in our lake in the first place, so that's a good thing. When that's present, researchers have found, we tend to see a higher degree of perceived self-efficacy or sense that you can accomplish what you put your mind to. Okay? Another piece of it is the companion feedback. So not necessarily the guy or gal in the other boat or down the shoreline far away, but those in your particular personal party or group. Okay? So if you are bouldering or rock climbing with some friends and they are encouraging you as you are trying to send a particular problem, that is, achieve a particular climb's pitch, you can develop a sense of self-efficacy if they are giving you positive feedback. Hey, great job. Okay, there's another handhold just a little bit up and to the left of your left hand. It looks like it's sort of a two-finger-wide crack or notch. See if you can get a couple of fingers on that. That'll be the next move in this particular pitch. Okay, companion feedback. And finally, physiological arousal in terms of stress. in particular eustress. Okay, so eustress is the positive kind of stress, like your body is physiologically aroused, hormones, stress hormones are involved, but the adrenaline is a positive thing. It is helping you swerve or blast through the trees on your mountain bike safely and not sort of be half asleep as you're doing it, okay? That also contributes to a sense of self-efficacy because when you are recreating to the extent that your body is undergoing a positive stress response or positive physiological arousal, eustress, then you are focused, you are wired into the situation, and you are, in part, among other things, developing a higher sense or more fully developed sense of self-efficacy. Okay? So, we're really harping on the self-efficacy thing, but it's pretty important, and throughout the semester we'll see why. So, three dimensions of self-efficacy. First, magnitude. How big is it? Is it tiny? Is it huge? Okay? And this maps onto what's the perceived task difficulty. If you want to go for a walk around your neighborhood, that's a relatively low magnitude thing. If you want to walk from the West Coast to the East Coast along the Transamerica Trail, for example, that's a very high magnitude thing. Okay. Next, with generality, how much does the task relate to things that I've already accomplished? How much can I generalize what I know and have experienced and learned and sunk a bunch of money in terms of equipment and travel time into already, how much do those things all map onto what I'm setting myself to do next, okay? And finally, strength, right? What is the conviction that you have, the determination that you have, the willpower that you have to continue forward despite adverse developments, which is a fancy way of saying, when stuff goes wrong, are you likely to keep on going, figure out a way through based on your determination, or are you going to tap out, quit, walk away, and say, you know what, this isn't what I came for, I'm done. That's okay, maybe it's a safety issue, right? But in many cases, we see, in particular with folks who are highly developed in terms of their investment level or their attachment to or their centrality of forest recreation in defining themselves as human beings or as individuals, a very high degree of strength, the strength component of self-efficacy. Okay? What this does, where it leads us, is hopefully this idea of transference. Okay? So this is the big payoff for forest recreation and outdoor recreation. The sense of self-efficacy that you develop when rock climbing, when hunting, when fill in the blank, project caving, for example, cave diving, surfing, whatever it is. Can that sense of self-efficacy, that sense that you can accomplish both successfully and safely, whatever you set your mind to do, that transfers all over the place, into the classroom, into the workplace, into your personal relationships, typically, hopefully. Okay, so that's sort of one of the big payoffs of outdoor recreation. Okay, next slide. So, when we're looking at outdoor recreation from the exogenous parts of it, the parts that are not inside of you, inside of me, inside any particular individual, inside of groups of recreationists, that's the out there, or the exogenous parts, okay? So, we're going to class outdoor recreation, in particular forest recreation, and even more specifically wildland recreation, as first, dependent on the resource. It's not rock climbing if you don't have any rocks. And second, interactive with the resource. Okay, it's not just that the mountains are there, it's that you are walking up the mountains, or climbing up the mountains, or using this mountain ledge as a perch for your hunting expedition, or whatever. Okay, and that means some things for us and for the resources. That means that if you're a recreationist, you're looking for high-quality resources. Okay, there are lots and lots and lots of potential rock climbing routes on road cuts for the interstate. If you've ever seen a hillside that's been basically chopped off so the interstate can go through, that's called a road cut, or a cut and fill operation, where you take that stuff and sort of move it elsewhere to fill in a hole that the interstate has to go over. Okay, you could do a lot of rock climbing in places like that, but it's not a very high quality resource, or it's not typically regarded as a high quality resource because it's noisy, the air quality is terrible, it's very hot and dry and exposed. It's not a particularly pleasant experience for rock climbing. We tend to focus on much more natural, less developed places for stuff like rock climbing, camping, wilderness solitude, bird watching, lots of different forest recreation activities. And that means we need to make sure that the air quality is good, that the soundscape is pretty quiet so that you can hear things like birds chirping, leaves rustling, stuff like that. And that's a subtle thing because noise can spill over from very far away. So that means when we are interacting with a resource upon which we are dependent for our activity, it's got to be a pretty high quality resource. That is where you and I come in for this class, because park rangers, foresters, recreation specialists and technicians, whatever your job title is, it's your job to make sure that those resources are available, that they're cheap enough to get to, that they're safe enough, and that they're a very high quality in terms of ecological function and so forth. Okay? So we find that outdoor recreation, next slide, is the overlap between so-called human dimensions, all that endogenous stuff that we talked about inside of you, like self-efficacy, and the natural resource dimensions, all that exogenous stuff, like where are you going? What's the pond? What's the lake? What's the shoreline? The river? The mountain? The forest? The gorge? Wherever. Okay? Outdoor recreation is the overlap of those two areas. Now, let's nuance the human dimensions a little bit more and say, before we move on to the next slide, that human dimensions is also going to be all about getting to a place where it's not just the endogenous human dimensions, it's also about the exogenous human dimensions, the laws, the policy, the norms, the shared unspoken beliefs between you and me and the rest of society about what recreation is okay, acceptable, positive, worth it, stuff like that. Okay, so human dimensions includes everything inside of you and everything human-based outside of you. The natural resource dimension, that's pretty self-explanatory. Okay, we're going to pause the video and audio here and resume with the next slide, the myths of recreation. All right, welcome back for part two of our introduction to leisure, more specifically forest recreation and wildland recreation. We left off with just before the myths of recreation, and these are a couple of criticisms that have come up over the years from detractors of the field that don't particularly see the value of forest recreation and wildland recreation in particular. Namely, these are typically that it's amusement without any sort of real redeeming value. We've already talked a little bit about how even the ancient Greeks and Romans saw a personal, very, very utilitarian benefit to the idea of forest recreation, in the sense that it was building strength, it was physical fitness, it was renewing your mind, it was resting from the stresses of work and trying to survive in ancient times and so forth. And so the idea that recreation is strictly amusement without any sort of redeeming value, that's typically something we see more aimed towards entertainment. So folks plugged into video games or just sort of watching TV all afternoon long, stuff like that. Not really building anything constructive per se. We do consider that leisure, but maybe less constructive, maybe less active than recreation in all of its various forms. Okay. Second is that it's just pure escapism, that it is a way to just unplug from reality and detach from the difficulties and stresses of everyday life. That can be one sort of side effect of recreation, but that's not necessarily bad per se, right? We do need a chance to get away from work from time to time for basic mental health and maintenance reasons, and also for physical health. For those of us who are either religious or spiritual, there are also very commonly identified spiritual benefits to recreation, sort of the solitude, the chance to contemplate and pray if that's something that you are into. So the idea that forest recreation is simply escapism doesn't really hold up when you really start tallying up all the actual benefits and effects of it. Okay, finally, it's seen as by some lacking purpose and discipline. We've already talked a lot about various purposes of recreation and benefits that we get from it. These tend to be the motivations or the reasons why people undertake forest recreation, but the idea that it lacks any discipline is not necessarily true at all. So a little bit later in the end of the semester, we will take a close look at the idea of risk and safety in outdoor recreation, and in particular forest recreation. talking about all kinds of gory stories, why people die in outdoor recreation fairly regularly, and so forth. So the idea that you can just go out there in an undisciplined way, in an unprepared way, and be completely fine is, well, it's a nice fantasy, but there are a lot of things that can go wrong when you are exposed to the weather, when you're away from emergency services, when you have to do things like poop in the woods hygienically and not sort of get yourself or anybody else who's with you very sick. Lots of ways things could go wrong, so discipline is definitely a part of effective forest and safe forest recreation. Okay, next slide. Looking at recreation and education, we tend to see forest recreation used as a tool to help accomplish some other things. So if you've ever been to a summer camp, for example, if you've ever been on an organized class field trip, one of the main reasons that those are undertaken is because when you take people away from their typical sort of everyday context, you sort of flip on a lot of switches, a lot of light switches in people's brains. People learn more easily. They learn more effectively. They learn more quickly. All of these things are tied to a whole bunch of different reasons that we'll talk about later. But the idea is that you can use outdoor recreation sort of in an adapted format to make the forest, the beach, the ocean, wherever you are, a very, very powerful kind of classroom. So out of that, we see a couple of different flavors of education happening in different ways and using forest recreation resources in different ways to accomplish some of those educational goals. Like, for example, first, experiential education. This is not automatically anything to do with forest recreation, but sometimes it does roll in elements of forest recreation. So the idea here is whether you're indoors or outdoors, behind a desk or sitting on a cliff top with your legs dangling over the edge, you are learning by doing things instead of by hearing about them or reading about them or watching lectures on a video about them, right? Okay, so this is learning to be a blacksmith by picking up a hammer and doing it, hopefully under the close guidance and tutelage of an experienced blacksmith, for example. But it's done as a guided exploration of why the doing works. So you do the thing. This is very commonly used in things like leadership training. So the military, of course, is all about building leadership and discipline and highly functional soldiers in very stressful kinds of environments. So many of their training missions happen outdoors so that they are a little bit more engaged with the training and able to function in very difficult and dangerous outdoor environments, typically. All right, so you head out to the place, and in a leadership education type format, you practice different team building exercises, practice communication exercises, practice navigation, wayfinding, and orienteering, which, so orienteering is, where am I? Navigation is, how do I get there? And so forth. And then typically you bring the students back together, do a quick debrief. Sometimes they're called circles, right? Everybody gets in a circle and sort of talks one at a time. How did it go? What did you learn? What did you feel? What did you experience? Is there anything that should have gone a little bit better than it did? What did you expect? How did we meet or miss those expectations? When you're doing these things outdoors and you can sort of dangle your feet in the cool pond or you're drying off after the swim or you've done a high ropes course, experiential education is a way to use forest recreation resources to help accomplish those learning objectives very effectively, very effectively. Adventure education is related, but it's not the same thing as experiential ed, so we want to hold those as separate concepts in terms of vocabulary for this class. So, adventure education tends to show up a lot in organizations like NOLS, the Outdoor Leadership Schools, or Outward Bound is another organization, if you're familiar with either of those. They do a lot of what's called challenge-based learning. So the idea here is to take typically junior high, high school, sometimes college-age students out to a wildland space. So it might be sea kayaking, it might be a long-distance backpacking trip, up in the wilderness of Alaska, something like that. And you pose a series of challenges that are successively more and more difficult, successively requiring more and more skill, potentially specialized equipment like lightweight backpacking gear or flotation devices, radio communication, stuff like that. And then you set up those challenges in a sequence so that you sort of not only build the skill as everybody's sort of moving through this outdoor environment on the kayaking trip, You also build their confidence and sort of the willingness to be able to use those tools as necessary. So in many cases, a Knowles trip will be a week or two long, for example, or maybe a month long, and the last several nights of it are the sort of thing where the instructor, you know, gives you a match and a knife, maybe a big knife, maybe a small knife, depends on the class, and says, okay, I'll see you in 3 days. And you, based on what you've learned over the previous days or weeks, head out, find water, make the water safe to drink, find food, find safe food, prepare it effectively, build yourself shelter, practice leave no trace principles, and so forth, so that, you know, ostensibly the person gets back after those 2 or 3 days solo with just a match and a knife, for example, and they're still alive at the end of it, and that's a good thing. And so that builds a whole lot of that self-efficacy stuff we were talking about just a minute ago. So this is one place where that shows up. It tends to be a pretty expensive way to do education, but a highly effective way to do education. Several of our current students, graduate students, many of our alumni have done adventure education type things. And you can really tell the difference when you start talking with these folks in terms of their sense of self-efficacy, their self-confidence. In many cases, their self-discipline is much more developed than other folks that we talk to. So adventure education is a powerful tool for personal development, not always the cheapest thing in the world. Okay, two other kinds of ways that education can show up in an outdoor recreation context. Next is outdoor education. So this is not the same thing as experiential ed. Again, not the same thing as adventure education, but related. So outdoor education is simply, you know, your teacher or professor or instructor takes you outside and tells you about the forest ecosystem you're standing in, okay? Takes you outside of the classroom or on a field trip, and you learn about the physical resources, and in many cases, the human or social history involved as well. And the idea is that by knowing more about those resources and how they function, how they fit together, how they've reached the point that they at which they are now, you can better appreciate those things. Okay, so the fourth and final way that education shows up in the context of forest recreation or using forest recreation as a tool is environmental interpretation, which is also a senior level class here in the forestry department. And environmental interpretation is not so much about relaying a bunch of facts about the resources. That's one of the primary functions of it, but it's not sort of the end goal of it. In the same way that it is sort of the end goal of outdoor education. So you go to a field trip, if you grew up in Illinois, to Cahokia Mounds. That would be outdoor education as a junior high or high school field trip. In environmental interpretation, your role as, for example, the environmental interpretive ranger or naturalist might be to introduce people to a bunch of the facts about whatever resource you're concerned with, maybe the nearby reptiles, or we live in the Mississippi Flyway, sort of bird migration corridor here in Illinois. So you teach a little bit about those things, but you do it in a way that seeks to build a very personal connection with those resources in terms of your audience members or participants. And you help them hopefully fall in love with it. So outdoor education is strictly about the facts. Environmental interpretation likes to use those facts to build a personal connection, maybe sort of spark an interior revolution in, hopefully, many of the participants or audience members. So they're not quite the same thing. It's knowing a lot of facts about it versus being very passionate about it. Sometimes those overlap, sometimes they don't. Okay, next slide. So here we have an adaptation of what's called Maslow's hierarchy. And what we want to do here is try to locate forest recreation on sort of this spectrum of the human condition. So at the very bottom we have crime and delinquency. At the very top we have constructive creativity. So the idea here is that typically when someone gets involved in forest recreation in any capacity, they are on average or typically lower on this sort of human condition scale than folks who have been doing forest recreation for a long time. Here's how it works. Okay, so let's say you start out as an elementary school kid and you go on a family camping trip. That happens every summer, and it's a good thing, and so forth, and you build a lot of social skills and family relation skills as a relation, as a function of being sort of in that space, cooped up in a tent with snoring parents and a cranky brother or sister. We all have been there. Maybe many of us have been there anyway. And the idea is that the more that you do things like that, the less likely you are, based on that strengthened family relationship, ideally, to do things like crime and delinquency. To be just full of empty hands and wasted time, so to speak. Okay. The next step up from that is sort of a low-quality obsession, is the term used in the literature or the research, where maybe you're into backpacking as an evolution or a step up from those family camping trips, but it's not, it's sort of a low wattage bulb. It's not very intense. It's not, you're not putting much effort or thought into it. You're just sort of throwing a bunch of stuff in a rucksack and going out. You might be pretty poorly prepared. Maybe forgot to check the weather on the way out, stuff like that. Pack the right kind of food, and oh yeah, I forgot to pack a stove, so that's going to be a problem. So low quality obsession. And then you move up the scale to amusement as you learn a little bit more about it. You get to a place where you can at least be sort of basically functional and safe when backpacking, mountain bike riding, fill in the blank activity. And then you start to get a little bit more into it as these trips start going a little bit better and better. You get better at it. You get safer at it. You get more effective at reaching the goals that brought you out there in the first place. That brings you to typically a place of emotional participation where you're backpacking maybe occasionally or out for a hike occasionally, but the largest part of your involvement with activity or the community is actually through others. We would call that emotional participation or sort of living vicariously through others. Sound familiar? All right. That idea also shows up in the self-efficacy model, so check that out if you're not sure where that fits in. Okay. The next step up is, of course, active participation. At this point, you've gone on enough backpacking trips that you sort of consider it a part of your life, your routine, your habit, maybe even your identity. Okay. And for folks who get into active participation at a very high level, they start to take what's called a critical look at the activity and not just do it, but modify it, grow it, improve it, right? So this is how we go from ceramic pots in ancient times to metal cookware, right? And in the early days, pioneers, settlers, campers would use things like an iron pot or cauldron to cook in because that's what they had. And then we sort of move forward a little bit and get to the place of using steel cookware, which is a tiny fraction of the weight and bulk that a big iron cookpot is. So you can go a little bit faster, you can go a little bit farther, a little bit less risk of injury from a heavy-duty backpack compressing your spine. From there, we get to aluminum cookware, which is a whole lot more lightweight than steel, and pretty much just as effective. And for the really hardcore lightweight backpackers, they have evolved the cookware from iron to steel to aluminum to titanium, which is extremely light. So that's just one example of how sort of active participation can evolve into creativity. And so you make these sort of quantum leaps in things like gear and techniques and new activities, right? So tightrope walking gives way to slacklining. Rock climbing spawns things like bouldering, and so on and so forth, okay? So, the idea is when you get to the sort of creativity level of the human condition, you're functioning at a very high level. You're taking all of the knowledge and equipment and culture that's endemic to your particular passion or activity and sort of advancing the state of the art a little bit. It's pretty cool stuff. It's very satisfying, not easy, not necessarily easy to find, either. There are relatively few people that make it that far up this scale. But for those who do, they're typically at the apex of the community, and a lot of people are seeing what's going on. They're contributing a lot of those innovations or inventions back to the community. Hey, look at this cool new fire-starting technique I figured out, by the way. Stuff like that. Okay, next slide. Stages of recreation. We are talking about this stuff at a level of detail. Hopefully, you didn't think was possible, but here we go. All right. So, researchers back in the 1960s were a very special decade. We'll talk about why a little bit later. Anyway, researchers in the 1960s started taking a pretty close look at this massive explosion of forest recreation that was happening at the time. And when they started taking a look at how trips evolved, so that they could take that information back to what were basically at the time forest rangers and park rangers only. Take this information back to those professionals and say, okay, this is what people are doing, this is what people are expecting. Are you actually managing to provide this? They came up with this four-stage process to kind of describe and encapsulate how a typical recreation trip happens. Hopefully this seems pretty straightforward and intuitive, but let's go through all those sort of particular sub-pieces of it and get into it. We're going to come back to this idea, this four-stage process, a lot throughout the semester, so make sure you're real clear on this. If you're not, ask me about it, and we can get some clarification going. Excellent. First step, anticipation. Okay. And the very first sub-step under anticipation is discovery. So you can't really go backpacking very well until you have discovered the idea of backpacking. You can't do it until it's there. And how will people know unless you tell them, right? So maybe you stumble across some beautiful photos that people took and posted online to Flickr or Reddit or Imgur or wherever. And you see that beautiful mountain range in the background and you go, wow, I think that's a great idea, let's go do that trip, or one like it. That's the discovery piece. You got to first know it's there, and then second, once you've discovered it, it's got to take hold in you. That's the anticipation or the attraction piece, specifically attraction, excuse me. So the idea with attraction is, not only are those mountains beautiful, but it seems like a great idea to go buy a bunch of gear and fly out there and hike up into that mountain range, like along the John Muir Trail in the Sierra Nevadas of California, for example. In the Basin and Range mountain ranges of the Sonoran Desert in southwestern United States, across sort of the Ring Mountains all across Australia, right? You gotta know about these places first and then be excited enough to actually connect with them second. Now, this stage by itself might take most of a lifetime, right? You may not discover your love for Sergum Global Sailing until your 60s and you're retired and you finally got enough money for a sailboat, for example, so that attraction phase might be decades long. It might only be a couple of minutes if your buddy pops his or her head in the door and says, hey, you know, we're going rock climbing, why don't you come with? And you think about it and you go, okay, that sounds good, right? So it might be a few minutes, might be decades. Second, you've got the planning phase, okay? This is where you are acquiring things. First, information. Do I need a permit? How much does the permit cost? Do I need to demonstrate anything for the permit? Do I need to pay anything for the permit? Is the permit system run by the Forest Service, the Park Service, Fish and Wildlife, Bureau of Land Management, Bureau of Indian Affairs, Army Corps of Engineers, Department of Defense, runs a whole lot of outdoor recreation, believe it or not, by a state organization, by a not-for-profit, by a private company? Who's in charge of this mess, right? So that's information. Second is skills, okay? So, and then third is equipment. So you've got to have the skill to be able to use a fire starter or a fire steel, where you have steel in one hand, flint in the other, and strike sparks onto an ignition or ignitable or flammable material to get a fire going, right? It takes practice, so you have to acquire skills. Third is equipment. You got to have a backpack to go backpacking. You've got to have at least a little bit of safety gear to go rock climbing, typically, unless you're free soloing, which is pretty dangerous. Okay, so you got to accumulate all of these things before you can genuinely sort of feel comfortable and be successful in your trip, typically. Okay, and different kinds of activities, different settings require different degrees of each. So, for example, a good friend of mine, after I finished hiking the Appalachian Trail in 2004, 10 years ago, decided to be a hut caretaker over the winter in the White Mountains of New Hampshire throughout the winter months. So they just need one person to sort of go between a couple of these different alpine huts that are at 3,000 to 5,000 feet altitude, buried under feet of snow all winter long. Winter temperatures down into the negative 30s, 40s, 50 degrees, gets pretty cold up there. And in that case, you got to have a lot of information like a fresh weather report, like solo survival self-rescue skills like glissade, which is where you sit on your butt and sort of slide down a steep glacier or snowfield and use an ice axe as a brake behind you. It's a very specific way to do that successfully, and if you start to tumble, there's a very specific way to stop that tumble. If you don't know those things, you're going to have a bad time if you're up in the White Mountains in the winter as a hut caretaker. But you also need equipment. No matter how skilled you are, you've got to have a very big sort of Michelin man puffy snowsuit, basically, that can keep you safe and alive down at the negative 50 degrees Fahrenheit, because the wind chill up on an exposed mountain ridge gets pretty ridiculous. Okay, so information, skills, and equipment all figure into the planning phase. What maps do I need? What time of the year do I need to go? What time of the year is this place closed? All of that stuff. Okay, third stage is participation, and this is typically, for most people, the shortest phase. Right? So if the anticipation phase and or the planning phases together can last you a lifetime, maybe that trip, that dream trip you always wanted to take to Fiji, to the Hawaiian Islands, to beautiful Giant City State Park, maybe that only takes an hour, or a day, or a week, or a month, or 6 months if you're lucky, right? But the anticipation planning typically take a whole lot longer. So you actually go in, you do the activity, okay? And we might also put in here as extra bullet points the travel to and the travel from part, which are either part of your planning process, if you're not really looking at those as part of the adventure, or they're part of the participation phase, if you're looking at that travel as part of the adventure itself, okay? So one thing we see at a lot of national parks and mountainous areas is that you've got spots that people are going to, the attraction or icon site, like a waterfall vista, right? But you've also got roads that are built in a way not just to get you from point A to point B, but specifically designed and constructed to give you a beautiful view around every corner kind of thing, okay? It's a lot more expensive to build and maintain a road that does that versus one that just goes straight from the gate to the waterfall view, okay? So the participation phase now is used to include travel to and travel from to try and give outdoor recreationists a bit of an extra sort of set of experiences or buzz, so to speak, okay? And then we move into the recollection phase. So that is primarily consisting of two things for each individual trip, but also these two things for the sum total of your experiences, okay? And each of you and I can probably come up with a whole lot of these based on some of our own past memories. So first, recounting. What memories do you have, okay? What stories do you tell about the trip? Oh, yeah, I have this really cool scar. Let me tell you all about it kind of thing. I was fighting off the bear, blah, 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 right? Okay. And every time the bear gets bigger, every time the fish gets bigger, every time the crazy locals get crazier and so forth, every recounting tends to evolve the memory just a little bit, right? It's the idea of the fishtail. But the idea is that it's so important to you, you feel like this story's got to be told, right? So if you're at a party and you find yourself recounting stories of that crazy camping trip you went on last spring break, you're experiencing what these researchers were talking about in the recollection and the recounting, okay? The other piece is the mementos. Now, mementos have changed over time. So, in earlier days, 1800s for example, it was very, very, very common to bring back a piece of the cave, for example, if you went spelunking in a cave. Now, spelunking is sort of tourism that happens to be underground. It's kind of low grade, it's not well run, that sort of thing. And one artifact, no pun intended, of that is that people like to bring a specimen of a blind cavefish with them. Like to snap off the tip of the stalagmite growing up from the bottom of the cave, or the stalactite growing down from the bottom of the cave, and put it on the mantle at home. Those would be examples of mementos. Petrified wood is another great example that a lot of people like to bring back, or are tempted to bring back from a place. These days, we've kind of been doing outdoor recreation long enough at places like our national parks, Petrified Forest National Monument, for example, that you can actually see the cumulative effect of decades of memento collecting, right? So here's where we get some problems. So if you look at photos of a petrified forest area from, say, 1940 to today, there are often visible differences, visibly less petrified wood around because so many people have taken it. So these days, we lean into educational programs like Respect the Resource, Leave No Trace is another one, all designed to make sure that some of that petrified wood is still in place for our great-great-great-great-grandkids 1,000 years from now, in the same way that it is for us, okay? So the mementos have been typically shifted towards digital mementos, photographs, for example, videos, for example. Everybody's got the same crappy cell phone picture of Half Dome from Inspiration Point when you go to Yosemite National Park, right? We just got to take that picture because we came all this way, we might as well. Even though I can get a better picture from downloading it online, from buying the postcard in the visitor center, from buying the postcard in the gazillion little touristy shops along the way. I gotta get that photo because it's my photo and it proves that I was there, right? That's also a memento. Another kind of memento is also linked with environmental interpretation. So researchers and practitioners, environmental interpreters, have found over the years that one fantastic way to build a sense of personal connection with a resource that you're trying to interpret or the place that you are bringing people to for outdoor recreation is to sell mementos of it. So guidebooks, picture books, right? Period accurate candy like rock candy from areas that were settled by pioneers. Replica points, that is arrowheads and spear points, potsherds, stuff like that. And that's a perfectly legitimate way to both boost the local economy and to build a connection and provide satisfaction for that desire to have some kind of a memento of a trip. So if you have any sort of touristy looking stuff on your old shelf at home, for example, that is very commonly an example of memento of a trip. Okay? So hopefully that sounds like a pretty familiar concept for you. So those four stages are going to show up in our conversations a whole lot. Make sure you're right up to date with each of those four and then sort of the sub-slices of each one, the bullet points under each one. Okay. Next, we've got the classes of recreation. This is a pretty straightforward thing. We're not going to spend a whole lot of time on it, but for every kind of recreation activity that we talk about this semester, have in the back of your mind this little sort of three-way diagram, okay? So we've got resource-oriented outdoor recreation, stuff that absolutely can't happen unless it's got a very specific set of resources available. We've got user-oriented recreation, where it doesn't particularly matter a whole lot if you're attached to a particular instance of a resource or not, and then sort of everything in between, or the intermediate classes of recreation, okay? So this is another way to understand the difference between sports and outdoor recreation. Sports has a lot of rules. Outdoor recreation doesn't really have rules. There are a lot of customs, there are a lot of norms, which are unspoken, sort of shared understandings of what's appropriate, but they're not necessarily hard and fast rules. Sports, on the other hand, have starting and ending times. They have halves or periods or thirds. They have teams. There aren't really teams typically in forest recreation, right? Also, and here's how this sort of plugs into the classes of recreation, sports can happen independent of settings. That is, there are soccer fields all over the world. They're all pretty much the same size. They're all flat. And it doesn't particularly matter if it's on turf, well, maybe it does if you don't want to get injured, or on regular grass, right? But, right, you can have a baseball stadium anywhere. You can have a cricket pitch anywhere. You can have whatever, fill in the blank sport, right? Street hockey on any street, as long as you're not in San Francisco. That would be a bad idea. Outdoor recreation, on the other hand, is very specifically tied to the resource, right? So you can't go rock climbing unless there are rocks. And for a lot of rock climbers, especially those a little bit higher on that human condition scale, very specific places are important. Okay, so there's a place called Camp 4 in Yosemite National Park in the middle of a very steep-walled valley with walls a couple of thousand feet high. It's a big, big place if you've never been there before. Check out some photos online. Anyway, there's a little world-famous climbers camp kind of right at the base of one of those walls, and there are all sorts of world-class climbs very close to that place. El Capitan, which is a major spot on the wall of Yosemite Valley, is right down the road from there. And so if you want to do some world-class rock climbing, you have to go there. There is no other substitute for El Cap anywhere else in the world. Now, there are a lot of other good climbs, but for people who are interested in climbing that particular world-class spot, there's no substitute, right? We can't have one in Sao Paulo, we can't have one in Columbus, we can't have one in Indianapolis or Sacramento, right? in the same way that we can have a soccer field kind of anywhere it's flat for a couple hundred yards in any direction. So there's a major difference between forest rec and resource-oriented forest, forest rec and sports. Okay, and that's going to be kind of the big distinction. So our sort of Venn diagram titled Outdoor Recreation on the next slide helps us sort of figure out how these Russian nesting dolls actually nest together. Okay, so leisure is the most broad, free time, unobligated time, unstructured time. A subset of that is going to be recreation. A subset of recreation is going to be outdoor recreation, where it is resource-focused versus sports. Okay, and then forest recreation is specific settings and specific activities within the broader field of outdoor recreation. Okay, so we wouldn't consider sea kayaking to be forest recreation, but it is outdoor recreation, and it's definitely not just passive leisure, like sitting on the couch and watching TV. Okay, all right. Cool. A couple of other sub-flavors or species of outdoor recreation that we want to be real clear on. Wildland recreation. That's where you are way off in the hinterlands. It's focused on undeveloped places where you're not going to cross a lot of roads. You're not going to have access to AC power and so on and so forth. Urban recreation is very much the opposite of that, but looking at the urban environment in a wildland kind of way. So in places where there are abandoned buildings, in spots where there are steam tunnels, like on SIU's campus, derelict old structures that you can scramble up and through and on and into and so forth, abandoned old mental hospitals that are really creepy and so forth. There are really funny YouTube videos of people exploring those and getting spooked by each other, basically. That's sort of a new kind of outdoor recreation, urban, okay? Parkour is another example of this, where people are doing somersaults and jackflips and all kinds of crazy gymnastics in an urban environment. That's called parkour, and that's another example of urban recreation using a very developed place, downtown city, for example, in a very wildland kind of way. Okay. Next, when we refer to adventure recreation, what we're talking about is sort of the forest recreation side of that adventure education stuff. So adventure education is forest recreation that puts a lot of emphasis on danger, challenge, risk, sort of epic tales. So you're going higher, you're going farther, you're going faster, you're going whatever, fill in the blank, it's more, okay? Risk-oriented outdoor recreation is sort of a subset of maybe adventure recreation where the whole point, the driving force, is the adrenaline rush of not knowing whether you're going to survive. Okay, so stuff like base jumping, stuff like hang gliding, stuff like wingsuit jumping when you look like one of those flying squirrels. Yeah, that's risk-oriented recreation. It's highly dangerous done wrong. Done right, it's fine. But you have to have a lot of high-level skill and typically a lot of experience and very specialized equipment to tackle risk-oriented recreation effectively, right? All right, so if you are into that stuff, you already know it, and you're probably pretty deep into it. Watch out for that spiraling adrenaline addiction. Okay, next slide, recreation under the hood. Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about how sort of the idea of recreation, forest recreation, and all of the perceived benefits and values and risk and all of that sort of come together and actually work under the hood, so to speak. Here's sort of an early peek at the mechanics of it. All right, so you start with motivations and preferences. Answering the question, why? Why are we doing this? Why are we buying a bunch of expensive fishing gear? Why are we buying another hunting rifle when the last one works perfectly fine? It's just this one's a little bit nicer, right? So you get into the sense of not just checking the box to have the gear, but having the gear that you want, going to the places that you are wanting to go to instead of the places that'll just sort of connect you with a end result, but not necessarily the one that you were shooting for. No pun intended. Okay? Those motivations and preferences will take you to specific activities and settings and help you choose the kind of companions you want to be there with, if any. Some kinds of activities lend themselves very well to solo, trekking and travel and so forth. Others just work a whole lot better with a fun, tightly knit group of people involved, like whitewater rafting, for example. whitewater kayaking. Perfectly fun solo, a little bit more dangerous solo, right? So, those motivations and preferences shove you towards particular activities, settings, and companions. And out of those things, you get recreation experiences. Okay? Why are we going through this model? Because this is pretty important for anybody who wants to go into forest recreation as, or anything connected to forest recreation as a career, right? Because when you are a park ranger, for example, when you're a forest ranger, for example, or what have you, working with recreationists, you're typically focused on the setting, right? The setting is your park. The setting is your wildlife preserve or wherever you're working, okay? But there are all these other pieces of it that have to come in and work properly in order for those high-quality experiences to happen, for people to come away happy, for people to come away alive, for people to come away full of stories that they want to recount and full of mementos that they've collected along the way, hopefully mostly photos and not petrified wood and stuff like that. That's irreplaceable in a sense. It's very easy for the practitioner to sort of focus on that setting, the setting or the place where the activity is happening, and sort of miss out on making sure that they are providing and connecting with healthy motivations for being there, making sure they're connecting with people's preferences. So, in one sense, it's ecologically very sound to pack as many campsites into a tiny little campground as you possibly can, right? That way the rest of everything else is mostly not camped on, and that's good in terms of ecosystem structure and function. But we don't go camping to be cooped up with a lot of strangers, right? That's pretty awkward and uncomfortable. It's kind of awkward turtle. So you want to make sure that, let's say, as the campground planner or manager or architect, you are connecting with people's preferences for things like screening vegetation, space, access and distance to safe, clean drinking water, access and distance to restroom facilities or comfort stations, as they're called, and so forth, right? So it's not just about the forest that this stuff is happening in. It's all the reasons why people want to come to the forest. It's all the experiences that people are trying to take out of the forest with them and so forth. Okay? So it's important to keep this all in mind. Okay? All right. Let's look at it from another perspective here. So what recreation is not? We've already talked about how forest recreation is not sports or athletics. Not the same thing. The idea of sports and athletics is victory, fitness, and so forth, right? Socialization, stuff like that. With forest recreation, you can also get socialization, but it's not about winning per se, unless you're competing with yourself to accomplish new things. It's not really tourism either. So tourism for our purposes is going to be travel to, specifically to, highly supported industries and locations that are set up to take visitors, give them deeply curated experiences, and then send you off on your way. Okay, so a tourist would go through the Everglades on an airboat that they hired for the day, and with an airboat pilot that they're basically paying to take them out and tell them stories and so forth. Okay, an outdoor recreationist would move through the Everglades in their own canoe. See the difference? Okay, the tourist is going to go back to their hotel at the end of the day, at the edge of the Everglades. The outdoor recreationist is probably going to camp inside the Everglades on whatever dry spot they can find. Unfortunately, with the draining of the Everglades, there are going to be more and more dry spots, but that's neither here nor there. Anyway, another story for another time. Recreation is also not just free time, right? Because we look at what definition as free time, unstructured time, unobligated time? Leisure. Okay. Onward. The requirements of forest recreation are pretty straightforward, but just so that you have them in your notes, here they are. So first, there's got to be the appeal, right? Why is this interesting in the first place? Is it challenging? Is it a great way to lose some weight? Is it a great way to connect with friends or that special someone, right? What's the appeal? It's going to cost some money in terms of travel, equipment. Sometimes you have to buy knowledge in terms of training or guidebooks or skill sets, or you have to pay for your computer to look up a bunch of stuff online, right? There's always some kind of cost involved. There's also an investment of time, and we've talked about equipment and skills already, but you also need the area, the setting, the place, so that's where the foresters and park rangers work, but you also need the infrastructure. Okay, so the infrastructure is all the human development that's put in place on site to help you be successful. All right, and it's also all of the stuff that's draped around the site to help you be successful. So infrastructure is roads, it's the visitor center you stop at on the way in, it's also the power lines to the visitor center, it's the septic field behind the visitor center so that you can use the restroom before you head out on your hike, and so forth. Okay, so infrastructure is all of the built environment, the parking lots, the roofs, the street lamps, the loudspeakers, the tornado sirens, all that stuff. But infrastructure is also all those things that you find in the wildlands or the woods that's constructed as well. So infrastructure is also stuff like hiking trails, hitching posts for your horse, watering holes. It's also shelters along long-distance trails or alpine huts like we were talking about in the White Mountains. It's also those overlooks that the trail takes you to that the forest ranger is kind of hoping you'll see because it's a pretty cool spot, but they're also hoping you see that particular vista point, as it's called, or photo point, or observation point, whatever, so that you're not 100 yards to the left of it trampling a bunch of stuff, and you're not 100 yards to the right of it trampling a bunch of stuff, and you're not 10 yards in front of it falling off the edge of the cliff. So all of that is infrastructure. It's all sort of designed, built, and maintained. Occasionally it's removed when it's no longer appropriate. But all of those things are put in place so that you can be successful and safe in your forest recreation, okay? So, we don't necessarily think of a trail like a road, but on a practical level, it's very much like a road. You just happen to be on foot. Maybe you're on a wheeled vehicle if you're off-road motorcycling or mountain biking. Maybe you're on a pack animal, right? Okay. Next set of definitions. We want to talk about the idea of nature and natural. So, in this class, nature is kind of a wiggly concept. And this guy, Bruce Hull, wrote a book called Infinite Nature that talks about all the different things we might mean when we say the word nature. So, is nature kind and looking out for you and trying to provide you beautiful scenes like you see here? This is a shot of Yosemite Valley at sunrise or sunset, not sure which. Is nature Mother Nature, sort of a personified, benevolent figure? Is nature a real mother and kind of a bitch, right? Is nature a bunch of ecosystem services? Is nature where people are not? It's just sort of the absence of human, regular human presence. There aren't a whole lot of places like that left on the earth, but that might be how you think of nature, okay? What else? Nature might also be stuff like the wild creatures. Nature might be for you a very spiritual thing. And so each of the sort of things that you encounter along a trail, the rock, the boulder, the mountain lion sunbathing on the rock, the dead deer that the mountain lion was chomping on a second ago, all of those things might have some sort of spiritual aspect for you. Who knows? The point here is that nature doesn't mean the same thing for everybody. So, for this class, officially speaking, we're going to use nature or natural in terms of minimal signs of permanent human presence, minimal permanent human occupation, okay? So, if you're camping in the middle of the woods in Shawnee National Forest, just to the south of us, you might be the only person within, 1,500, 2,000 yards in any direction. That's pretty cool. Okay, maybe a couple of miles in any direction if you're way back in the middle of it. Now, that's not to sort of destroy the sense that that's still a natural place. It is still a natural place. The idea is that you're not there permanently. If that's your house, that's your house, and we're not going to call it a natural spot. Okay? So, again, a million different ways you can define nature. This is how we're going to do it for this class. The other half is that it's primarily dominated by non-human material and energy transfer. So ecosystem services and cycles, so sunlight energy coming in, thermal energy blowing in on the wind, water and nutrients and organic material flowing out with overland rainwater flow and channelized flow in rivers and streams and so forth. those processes dominate. It's not traffic. It's not construction. It's not everything's paved over. Those would be pretty non-natural places, at least for this class. Okay, so that's how we're going to use that particular term. Next term, protected area. This could be anything that we've set aside in part for forest recreation purposes. So, Shawnee National Forest is a good example. Shawnee National Forest is managed for timber, it's managed for clean watersheds, it's managed for wildlife habitat preservation or conservation, it's managed for recreation value, and in some cases, national forests are also managed for rangeland and so forth. But in our case, not so much rangeland. A protected area is at least set aside for forest recreation, not for stuff like strip malls and amusement parks and strip mines and so forth. Okay, so that can be a park, a preserve, a wilderness area, a wildlife management preserve, a natural heritage corridor. It could be a lot of different things. All right, wildlands are a very more natural, there's that term again, subset of protected areas. So parts of the Shawnee National Forest are pretty developed, right? There are little towns inside Shawnee National Forest. So those parts of the Shawnee are not wildlands, okay? Wildlands are pretty much wherever that permanent stuff is, okay? The more natural spaces. Wilderness is not the same thing as wildlands or protected areas. They're related, okay? Wildernesses are a subset of wildlands that are specifically designated to have no permanent signs of human presence, no mechanized management, meaning typically you can't ride a mountain bike through because that's mechanized transport. If you need to clear a trail, you can't use a chainsaw because that's a mechanized way to do it. You got to use a handsaw. Okay? The idea here is very, very primitive things, and if you have to use a tool to solve a problem in a wilderness area, it's typically required by law to be the most primitive tool that will get the job done. It's called the minimum tool rule. More on that later. Okay. Brief pause, and just a reminder of extra credit. This is about the 10th time I've managed extra credit for our class already, so make sure that you are looking for opportunities if you are interested. I've got a couple of pictures of what that can look like. This is a recent trail work day from, I guess that would have been with Green Earth Incorporated. It's a local not-for-profit here in Carbondale, if you are here in Carbondale. And they're hosting work days all the time. Their executive director, Steph Eicholtz, is an awesome gal. You can also talk with Shawnee National Forest's Kelly Pearson. She is amazing. She won a nationwide award a couple of years ago for being a volunteer coordinator. And it's tons of fun. She helps the forest get a ton of work done, and her volunteers have a blast while they're doing it. Okay? Also, Crab Orchard National Wildlife Refuge is just down the road from us here in Carbondale. They host all kinds of volunteer events, and it's a great way for many of the students who are interested in sort of more water-oriented stuff. Okay? So, lots of options for you. Those are just three out of dozens and dozens. So, think about it. All right. If you are doing the online section of Forestry 220, now's when you want to head back to the website and complete a couple of discussion questions on the discussion forum related to this introductory lecture and chapter one from your book. If you are in the classroom, brick and mortar section of this class, we'll be talking about some of this stuff in a class discussion format. Catch you later.